You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
You know, Donald Trump talks about stop and frisk like he knows the facts. He has had no experience with policing, no experience with public safety. He should really be careful, because if we reinstituted stop and frisk all over this country, you would see a lot more tension between police and community.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio believes that Donald Trump is advancing fat-headed opinions on a subject about which he knows nothing. My guests Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss this barely imaginable prospect, along with the day's other big stories, including ongoing unrest in Charlotte in protest at yet another police shooting of yet another black American, America's insistence on continuing to arm the one regime on Earth which seems most diametrically opposed to everything for which the US purports to stand, and a recruitment drive by Britain's intelligence services. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times, and Michael Goldfarb, journalist and host of the new FRDH podcast. Welcome both. And we will start in Charlotte, where North Carolina's Governor Pat McCrory has declared a state of emergency after two nights of protest following the killing of a black man by police. Keith Lamont Scott was shot dead on Tuesday. Police say he was carrying a handgun. His family say otherwise. He was the third black man known to have been killed by American police this week. The rider at time of broadcast feels depressingly necessary. Michael Goldfarb, first of all, we've had four police officers at least injured in the protest. There's one protester critically injured after apparently being shot by another protester. Is the official response, by which I mean, I guess, the tear gas and the state of emergency, justified?
Without being there, it's hard to say. Remember that North Carolina is the South. Remember that this particular governor... has overseen a lurch to the right in a state that has actually in national elections begun to shade to the left. So it's possible that there's a bit of overreaction at work. It's also possible that he was called on by the mayor of Charlotte to come in and help. The scenes are not nice to look at, and the black-on-black violence during the protest doesn't help the cause of calling attention to, you know, violence particularly focused on African Americans. Although in this case, let's be clear that the police officer who did shoot this guy is also an African American, and that needs to be stated as well.
On that subject, Michael, Mike, this is going to get confusing with the two Michaels, but Michael Binion, as Michael correctly points out, in this particular instance, the black man who's been shot was shot by a black police officer. It doesn't appear to have made the protests any less vehement. I guess the question I'm fumbling towards there is that in fact at all significant?
Well, it's of course significant, because it shows that the charge that it is simply white racists killing unarmed black protesters is not exactly that. It's much more a protest against the random shootings by police, or not even controlled shootings, the over-hasty reactions of a lot of police forces, which they will then say are essentially controlled by white governors or white police chiefs in the local area, even if the person who opened fire was himself.
This is the
man.
Argument that there's, I guess, an institutional culture
That's
of
it.
Racism.
Yes, as was the charge against the Metropolitan Police in London, that it was institutionally racist, even if not all those who were members of the force were themselves white people.
It does. That fact, though, that in this particular instance the officer involved is also black, does, at least this is what I've always wondered about all of these shootings there's been protest about. I don't think any sane person doubts that interactions with the law in America are different if you're black than if you're white. And I think this is the point at which we should acknowledge that this is three white guys having this conversation. But Michael Goldfarb, I just wonder how much of this might be different if American police didn't have to approach every single citizen making the assumption that this person might be easily as heavily armed as they are.
Oh, this is the gun the gun question. Yeah, possibly. Although I have to say that this is the almost inevitable end point of a quarter of a century of, I hate the word empowerment, but this is police empowerment. It's going back to the early 1990s in New York City, and I know we're going to talk about this in a minute. You know, the zero tolerance of crime led to a dramatic fall in crime rates in New York City, and it became all over the country. People just, you know, graffiti, you're arrested, you're going to jail. Break a window, you're a 15-year-old kid, you're going to jail. And the police have become, I have to say, a little bit too empowered to simply overreact in any given situation. You know, and the thing is, you know, this is also a very difficult time because there's all kinds of things going on. Not just the shooting in North Carolina, but there was one in Tulsa that...
Indeed.
And the facts that we know about it make it seem a much more racially charged case. But this is a moment when, for example, Colin Kaepernick, who's a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, has initiated a nationwide protest at sporting events of not standing for the national anthem. The Maine police unions have endorsed Donald Trump. And just today I was reading an article that black officers who are members of the police unions, like the Fraternal Order of Police, are considering making a separate endorsement because they don't endorse Donald Trump. It's highly charged. Blacks are disproportionately, whites are being shot as well, disproportionately targeted. And I don't know where this goes. The response needs, I think, particularly in Charlotte, to be perhaps a trifle more sensitive than it has been.
You mentioned Donald Trump, and you mentioned the broken windows policies, as it was known. And New York City under Rudolph Giuliani was, of course, one of the crucibles of that policy. Donald Trump has suggested that Chicago's gun crime problem specifically might be ameliorated by imposing a stop-and-frisk regime. Bill de Blasio, as we heard in the introduction, begs to differ. Here is a bit more of what his honor had to say.
Stop and frisk was intensified for a limited period of time in the last decade in particular. And the bottom line is it created a huge amount of division between police and community. We ended that unconstitutional use of stop and frisk, that overuse of stop and frisk. What's happened in the 3 years since we made the change? Crime has gone down consistently since we actually stopped using it. Bill Bratton would say that what we need to do if we want more safety is bring police and community closer together. That's what proved to be the case. So, you know, Donald Trump talks about stop and frisk like he knows the facts. He has had no experience with policing, no experience with public safety. He should really be careful because if we reinstituted stop and frisk all over this country, you would see a lot more tension between police and community.
Michael Binion, final thought on this. That was Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York City. Stop and frisk or variations on that have been attempted or advocated in London as well from time to time, often in response to spikes in knife crime rather than gun crime. But even if it is legal, and in the United States that is a bit of a grey area, does it actually work? Or as His Honour was suggesting there, does it actually cause more troubles than it solves?
Well, it works for a bit, and it works if people feel that there is a particular spike in some difficult, knife crime is a good example, and that communities feel that there are groups of people who are very likely to be carrying out this crime, and the police presence, visible police presence on the street, can make things better. But again, if it becomes routine, and if it's based entirely on racial profiling, which tends to be the case, then it is counterproductive, because it actually gets in the way of better community relations between police and, all groups, especially minority ethnic groups, which is the only way in the end to stop a sort of polarization.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Syria, where those in the habit of betting against form might have been tempted to take the optimistic view about the ceasefire that was declared last week. That truce is now in ruins, as is even more of Aleppo, following what are being reported as the heaviest airstrikes in months. Further fighting has also been reported in the parts of the city where rebels are trying to break the siege by government forces. These unhappy developments follow, of course, Monday's apparent bombing of an aid convoy and Red Crescent warehouse, which has been widely blamed on Russia, who, as is usual in such circumstances, are denying everything. Michael Goldfarb, is it, I don't even know if it back to square one. Square one seems like so long ago now. Is this back to square one, or are we somewhere behind square one or on some other square entirely, which might not be square one but still isn't really getting us anywhere?
It's like we've entered entropy here, but the entropic state is not one of calmness and stillness. It's one of low intensity conflict that just carries on and on and on. I don't think we're back at square one. I just think in all directions, there is no beginning and no end. Now, we can't see where it started, and I don't think anyone who really thinks about it can see what the end is, because other than utter exhaustion in Syria, and it seems inexhaustible. I don't know what can be done now. I mean, I feel the best thing that could happen just is to let it go from the American point of view. Wait till there's a new president. The big problem, of course, is that the American strategy has always been get rid of ISIS first and then deal with Syria. But you can't really separate the problems. Now they're beginning, if my sources are correct, and they're pretty public sources, you know, they're getting ready to go into Mosul in Iraq, and they'll try and get it at ISIS there, which is the biggest city they command anywhere now in the Middle East. I don't know how you do that if you're at odds with Russia, if you're at odds with all of your partners. So it's extremely difficult. But my guess is that now they'll just let it be until after November 8th and see who wins the presidency, and then it'll be their problem.
Michael Binion, just to return to Syria in particular, does, for all America's attempts recently to impose themselves largely via the instrument of this ceasefire, does it still seem to you that Syria slash Russia, or even possibly Russia slash Syria, are still basically running this show?
Yes, of course, because they have the planes and they're not afraid to use them. And the Syrian government is now
And I guess emboldened. You could argue they're not terrifically squeamish about what they use them on.
Not at all. And in fact, they're quite deliberate. They targeted this aid convoy in retaliation for what they don't believe was a mistake, namely the Americans bombing a group of Syrian soldiers who are their allies, of course. And it was a sort of saying, well, we can make mistakes as well. They simply denied it, as you said. They will deny everything, and it's very hard to know how to prove that they... I mean, the Americans have all the intelligence, they have all the satellite pictures and all that, but the Russians just, shrug it off. And the rest of the world doesn't particularly care. What they care about is the fact the fighting is still going on, and now the waters have been so muddied that nobody quite knows who started it, who is to blame, how we get out of it. And meanwhile, Assad repeats his mantra, which is, I want the control of all my country back again. He's ready for a final military push to win all of it.
Are we seeing there, Michael Goldfarb, I guess a difference, a distinct difference in military and political cultures between the United States and Russia in particular? Because as Michael points out, there was this incident which American planes apparently mistakenly bombed Syrian troops. The Americans have at least attempted to, I guess, make excuses for it or offer an explanation for it, whereas Russia just seems to do things and either say we did it and we don't care what you think, or they deny that we did it. There's been various Russian denials and misdirects about the aid convoy bombing. They've kind of hinted that an American Predator drone was in the vicinity, as well as any Russian Sukhoi jets that may have been.
Yeah, but the Russians have been doing this on the border with Ukraine as well.
Indeed.
I don't think people believe much, except, I suppose, certain figures on the hard left and the hard right in both America and Britain who blame American and Britain's mainstream politicians for all that's wrong in the world and for some reason seem to like Vladimir Putin. There is people who are listening, if you just Google open source convoy bombing, you will have endless amounts of pictures. I mean, this is not top secret stuff. I mean, there's plenty of pictures that have come out, eyes in the sky kinds of pictures, and you can form your own opinion about, was there a mortar being dragged into position by some Syrian rebel group and was using the UN convoy for cover? Possibly. Do you take out 18 UN trucks killing dozens in retaliation? I don't know. I think you'd probably best served in trying to understand the world by assuming that Russia does what Russia does, and it's probably not how you would go about doing things, and then proceed from there.
Michael, it's almost not impossible to predict the future in Syria. You usually don't go too far wrong by assuming that things are going to get even worse. But from the point of view of Bashar al-Assad, is there any imaginable incentive for him to stop at this point?
Not really, no, except that he is rather low on soldiers. I mean, he's got through quite a number of people in his own army, and there is the possibility that the Sunni rank and file will not really continue supporting the Alawite officers and the Alawite government. But I think that's a minor thing as long as he's got Russian backing. His policy is very much like, to quote Tacitus, they create a desert and call it peace. And that's what he's done. He's practically destroyed the whole of Syria.
Well, on that classical allusion, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, America's ongoing enthusiasm for sending tanks to the Middle East, one way or another.
Design Diaries at the ready. You've got an appointment to keep. Tuesday, the 18th of October at 1900 marks the latest in our series of live broadcasts from our Marylebone headquarters. It's our weekly design show. It's Section D and it's live. Join me, Josh Fennett, and a host of panellists, including famed typographer Eric Speakerman and the V&A's Joanna Agerman-Ross, among others, for a glass of wine and an evening of lively debate on the future of the design industry. Section D Live. For tickets and information, head to monocle.com/events.
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the affairs section, I head to the Netherlands to find out why Europe's most liberal nation is becoming increasingly right-wing.
The October issue sees the return in the business section of our annual retail survey, where we profile the best new stores, the smartest developers rethinking retail, and the world's great shopping streets.
In culture, we ask a leading question: how do you buy a work of art? To answer it, we have some of the leading lights of contemporary art, from a big league art advisor to an artist himself, who says, well, it's your money.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb. Now, however resigned one is to the imperatives of real politic, there remain few less edifying spectacles than the perennial deference of the United States towards Saudi Arabia. At least a few American lawmakers appear to have come around to this point of view, staging a bipartisan attempt to have the US Senate block a massive new arms deal. This stand was voted down, however, 71-27, and Riyadh will therefore take delivery of roughly $1.15 billion worth of new kit, including another 130 Abrams battle tanks. News which is unlikely to prompt much rejoicing in Yemen, in particular. Michael Goldfarb, just to start with, just the stuff of a madman's dream, because it's Thursday evening, and why not? What would actually happen if the US and the wider West decided that Saudi Arabia was an impediment and embarrassment, and just said we're done with you people?
That is a Thursday dream.
Yeah.
Jeez. It won't happen. There's several things to say quickly. One is there's a perfect feedback loop. In other words, they have petrodollars, and it feeds back into the armament industry here, and we sell them by selling them armaments. That actually balances, to a certain degree, payments and trade. The second thing is that the vote in the Senate was less to do with people saying, well, this is just a bad idea, they're using it to bomb Yemen and kill innocent children in hospitals, but rather because the Saudis object to 20 pages in the 9/11 report being made public, and also that they might be liable in mm-hmm. civil court.
This is that other bill that is floating around that Obama may veto, but may not have the votes.
I mean, this
to
relates to, you know, did the Saudis know about 9/11? Did they encourage it and so on? And the third thing is you can't give the Israelis $2+ billion worth of or agree to sell to them. I mean, they don't, these things aren't handed out. You know, they're purchased in some ways, and then not expect to give the Saudis something as well. This has been going on. I mean, and that is a rhythm of life in Washington. If you give X to Israel, sell X to Israel, then the Saudis have to get their share as well, and that balances things out. And that's what's at work here.
Michael Binion, aside from all that, and that all depressing as it is all entirely true, of course, does we, by which I mean, you know, the secular democratic West, do we actually get anything out of our relationship with Saudi Arabia?
We get a lot of trade. Britain certainly does. It also sells arms. It sells a large number of general consumer goods. The Saudis are very large spenders when they come to Britain. They're very important tourists. And the Saudis, of course, are very close to the other Gulf states. And the Gulf states themselves also are huge trade partners, buying a lot of British and American stuff and coming in huge numbers to the West, coming to Manchester because they love the rain and spending a lot of money there. But the other problem for Britain about being too critical is that the Saudis have pointed the finger so clearly at Iran as being the instigator of the trouble in Yemen and saying, if you are principled in supporting a legitimate government, you have to oppose the Iranian-inspired rebellion. And Britain doesn't really, and nor do many Americans, doesn't really think that Iran has changed its spots, even if it has signed a nuclear deal. So a lot of people feel that Saudi Arabia is doing the West a favour by holding Iran to account.
I mean, Michael Goldfarb, it does seem, I guess, and you know, Michael mentions Iran there vaguely idle to start trying to decide which Middle Eastern tyranny or semi-tyranny is worse than any other. But is Saudi Arabia a special case? I guess I'm wondering, in the same way that a moral argument did stick around dealing with South Africa in the 70s and 80s, they weren't allowed to come to World Cups or Olympic Games, etc., etc. Why is it never quite stuck in the same way with Saudi Arabia, which you could certainly argue is at least as bad as apartheid South Africa was in many respects?
You know, this is a really good question, Andrew, and I'm not sure I have an answer, because as things have progressed over the last 15 years since the attacks of 9/11, or actually the last 25 years, going back to when the Saudis became American and the West's allies in trying to push the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. And in doing so, they sent their own crazies, including Osama bin Laden, to Afghanistan. And then we left him in Afghanistan, and you know, he did what he did and organized what he organized. I don't know. By many measures, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is retrograde, but you know, it has become the most important of the Arab countries, and I mean, and let's not forget that you know, in Egypt gets a tremendous amount of military aid from the United States as well. So, but you know, Egyptians have no great love for people from the Arabian Peninsula. They think they've got all the oil and don't share the revenue with their brother Arabs. It's an incredibly complicated situation. And now that we have a new alliance, Michael knows, you know, it's like Russia, Iran. This is the new alliance. So, of course, the West is going to cozy up to Saudi Arabia.
I think it's been a little bit unfair to say that, well, first of all, I don't agree it's comparable to apartheid South Africa, because it's not the Saudis discriminating racially against more than three quarters of their own population.
They discriminate by gender against a fair whack of their population.
Yes, but then they are actually making progress, apart from driving cars. They are beginning to make progress. For example, there are more female students in Saudi University than male students. You just have to look at where they've come from. I mean, it's very easy to say this is a medieval tribal kingdom. Well, you could have said that much more 40 to 50 years ago, when it certainly was just that, and medieval in every sense, it's certainly a long way from what we would regard as a sort of progressive regime of any kind. But the other thing I think that is important is it is a very important Muslim, well, it's the guardian of the holy places. So we slightly want that country on our side if we want to have reasonable relations with the Muslim world.
Well, finally tonight, we should look at a career opportunity, because Britain's foreign intelligence service, MI6, is to embark on a substantial recruiting drive, planning to add several hundred operatives to its current strength of 2,500 or so. The increase is apparently a response to the accelerating march of the internet. They are especially interested in hearing from people who understand anything about technology and speak foreign languages. That rules me out, gentlemen, but are either of you tempted?
Well, the thing is, people forget the difference between MI5 and MI6. MI6 is essentially spies working overseas. MI5 is domestic counterintelligence, and it's MI5 especially where you want a lot of people on the ground in Britain listening to plots and what's going on here. The recruitment for MI6 is to send a lot of people undercover in places like Pakistan or Iran or wherever it is. Now, that would never do. If you don't look local, you won't get recruited.
Yeah, I mean, I've reached an age now where I could easily put on a dirty Mac and be a John le Carré character and, you know, pass for Alec Guinness almost, except, well, I'd have to talk like this. Whisper. Michael's absolutely right. The recruitment drive is very much targeted on people who speak fluent languages,
yes,
in countries that are on the very edge of providing, you know, this actors in this world of terrorism we live in. So I'm not one. But, you know, if you were starting university now, you wouldn't go wrong if you learned Arabic.
As I did. Yes. And, some years ago, I didn't get the tap on the shoulder.
That was going to be my next question, because that was the proverbial legendary means of recruitment.
Well, it was Cambridge, and that's where they tapped it. from neither side.
I was going to say, did the KGB get to you first?
The thing is that as a foreign correspondent, I did meet and know quite a lot of MI6 people. And in fact, with one or two of them, I had quite a regular sort of dialogue. But there was one who had learnt exactly, as Michael said, to talk in that way that in a busy restaurant in Washington, you could never be overheard, because he'd talk rather like this all the time. And frankly, I could never hear a word he said. So
I've met more than a few myself. I think they enjoy that kind of thing, that little bit too much. But is the modern MI6 agent, I'll ask you, Michael Binion, likely to spend more time in front of a screen than in the field? Because I remember talking to one former MI6 spook from 80s and 90s vintage who was lamenting the internet in a way, because he said that, you know, years ago, if you wanted to find out something like, you know, the top speed of a Russian armored personnel carrier, that would take months of patient espionage, and now any Yahoo with a laptop can find it out in seconds.
That's right. Well, there's a third branch of British intelligence, which is GCHQ, General Command Headquarters in Cheltenham, which is a listening post, and that's where particularly technology comes in, and they've bumped up their numbers and recruitment as well, because that is particularly looking at technical stuff on the web and things of that kind. MI6 is still human intelligence, and quite a lot of people are posted to British embassies overseas where they're sort of liaisons with what's going on the ground. And so there's still a role there if you want to be a sort of Bond type figure. It's not quite as it is in the films, and it is a bit more routine.
But on that front, Michael Goldfarb, hasn't that kind of role now become impossible? Because you can get outed now in seconds, and that information could be spread to literally dozens, thousands, millions of people faster than you can be got out of the country.
That's entirely true. But just as in journalism, I mean, there's this idea that you can sit at a desk and fiddle around and Google around and come up with data sets, and this is the story. But honestly, human intelligence remains the thing. And, you know, it cuts the other way. You can identify a cell. You can hoik them off the street. The cell is only three or four people. It dissolves, and then you have to start all over again. I firmly believe that human intelligence gathered on site remains the best intelligence.
Well, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Beatrice Carmi. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Thanks also to our guests, Michael Binion and Michael Goldfarb. Music next at 1900. It's Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist, and I'll be back with more on the day's big stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.